Sunday, October 19th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents SOS, Calling All Black People, a book release party featuring Dr. Sonia Sanchez and co-editors Drs. John H. Bracey and James Smetert. Join us as we hear a presentation from Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn as we do our part to help this listener-supported experiment continue. That's Sunday, October 19th at 11 p.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. Live in the studio. Yeah, of course, I'm live every week, right? Right? Wink, wink. But tonight, we are going to ask for your assistance. We need your assistance, financial support, while you enjoy Voices of the Black Arts Movement. We're featuring a book. We're not featuring the actual book. That's going to be featured tomorrow. If you heard the promos earlier, Dred Scott Keyes is going to do that, whom I'd love to thank for providing the audio for this evening's and this premium. SOS, Calling All Black People, a Black Arts Movement reader. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. We're going to listen to some Train. Some John Coltrane while Max does some things in the background. Stay tuned.
In my book,
Hello, my name is Jim Smethers. I teach African American literature, culture, cultural history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst in the Department of Afro American Studies. I'm a scholar who's written mostly about 20th century African American literature, culture, politics, especially radical politics, and I've written a book about the Black Arts Movement called The Black Arts Movement, Literary Nationalism in the 1960s and 1970s, and more recently have edited a collection, a Black Arts Reader, a collection of work from that period with my colleague John Bracey, Jr., and the poet, educator, critic, playwright, you name it, Sonia Sanchez. The Black Arts Movement, it's like any kind of movement or any kind of period. It's not like you can absolutely say on this day in 1965 the movement started and on this day in 1975 or 1976 it ended. It's a lot messier than that. But basically what we're talking about when we talk about the Black Arts Movement is the cultural movement that was twinned with the Black Power Movement, roughly from about 1964, 1965 to the middle to late 1970s. And I say twinned with the Black Power Movement because, I mean, it's really the same movement, almost inseparable. Some people like to say that the Black Arts Movement is the cultural wing of the Black Power Movement, but I think that you could just as easily say that Black Power is the political wing of Black Arts. What they share in common is that Black people in the United States are, in fact, a people, a nation, if you will, who have the right, really the imperative to self-determination, to decide their own destiny, and to be free. And also, as a result, as sort of a corollary of being a people or a nation, that they have a culture that's attached to that nation, nationality, and that they should be developing that culture. That culture should serve as part of the struggle to determine one's own destiny to become freer. The Black Arts Movement, though, it's very hard, you know, once you've defined that, you know, or gone there, to really, you know, come to grips with, because it is such a successful movement. There was a period of time in the not-too-distant past that some folks would say that it wasn't that consequential. Henry Louis Gates Jr., who is a estimable scholar in many respects, but wrote some years ago in Time magazine that it was the shortest living, least consequential arts movement in history. But my contention is, in fact, and my co-editors on our new Black Arts Reader, that in fact it was arguably the most consequential arts movement ever. And it's partly that consequence of that success that makes it hard to define, because one thing about Black arts is that basically any place in the United States, and even beyond the United States, but certainly any place in the United States where there was any appreciable number of Black people, any town, any city, any campus, there was some manifestation of Black arts. There was a theater, there was a reading group, there was an arts gallery, there was a writer's workshop, there was a cultural center, there was a bookstore, you name it. In most places, or many places, many of these things at the same time. So that it was practically every place. There was a Black arts movement in Great Britain, for example, among Black Britons. In that sense, it was enormously consequential. And also because the idea of the movement, one thing that people had in common, even though they often disagreed on precisely what the Black nation was, what the culture was, what the path towards liberation should be, there was no pope of Black arts. There was no infallible leader who was laying down the law that said, you must be this, you must do that. There's a lot of debate. There's a lot of discussion. There's a lot of argument, as well as cooperation and, you know, collective expression, conventions, meetings, festivals, fairs, and all that sort of thing. One thing they all had in common is that this was art for the people, and that if it didn't reach the people, if the masses of Black people didn't receive this art, didn't identify with this art, didn't become engaged with this art, didn't help produce this art, then the movement really was a failure. So as a result, Black arts took place in all kinds of venues, bars, street corners, on flatbed trucks, in the streets, in community centers, in housing project courtyards, campus, Black cultural centers, you name it, it was happening. So consequently, they reached hundreds of thousands of people. And even if you think about TV shows that came into existence in the 60s and 70s, Soul, Like It Is, that were heavily influenced by Black arts and frequently featured Black arts artists, Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez, Amiri Baraka, just to name a few, then you're talking about millions of people.
Nikki Giovanni.
You've often been associated with the Black arts movement. What exactly mm-hmm. is your role?
Well, I'm a Black artist. I think that my role is to do my job. And I certainly am very fortunate because I've been teaching now for 26 years, 27 years. And Black arts said that we have to pay attention to Black people. And I think that that's important. And I've just been very fortunate in that I've been teaching a lot of really good writers. And so I don't think I can really take credit for their talent. I mean, they're just talented kids. And they just happen to come to me, and I don't destroy their talent. So I take credit for not messing up.
Excellent.
You know, nobody had really thought about Black people. Mm-hmm. And we have to give a lot of credit. Of course, the writers did a lot, and I was a part of that group. But we have to give a lot of credit to things like Soul,
sure.
the television show, Ellis Hazel. And when Ellis started Soul, there were no Blacks on TV. And then he did that, and then Tony Brown did Tony Brown's Journal, and he started to do that. And the guy who just died, who committed suicide,
Don Cornelius.
Mm-hmm. So these people hadn't been on before Ellis did that.
Right.
And Ellis not only brought us, I worked with Ellis in all of these shows, not only got the people on TV, but actually, you know, had people there to comb their hair and do the makeup and, you know, treat them like stars, like what they were. And that became very good because everybody was on Soul. You know, he was like a Black Ed Sullivan.
That's true. And then some.
The politicians, yeah. Right. I remember when Baraka came on, you know, because Baraka wasn't sure that he wanted to be on Soul. He thought it was kind of commercial. Mm. And it's like, yeah, it might be, but, you know, you're still Baraka, and you have to talk to your people.
You know, we're talking here again about a politically radical and aesthetically radical. There was no one aesthetic, but nonetheless, you would have to say that a lot of it was a pretty sharp break from stuff that had gone on in the past, although they look back towards people they honored as ancestors like Langston Hughes and Margaret Walker and Sterling Brown and so forth. But nonetheless, they were pretty radical in aesthetics and form as well as in politics. To actually reach that many people, I don't think there's ever been a kind of avant-garde in the United States in the arts that has reached so many people as the Black arts movement did. I think, consequently, the movement also, as a result of this, was very significant in that through this notion of radical art for the people, radical art that reached the people, that was radical and popular at the same time, that was visionary or vanguard and popular at the same time, it completely changed the attitude, the idea of what art is and what art can be for people throughout the United States, the African American community in the first place, but other communities in the United States. As the poet, critic, and arts institutional leader, A.B. Spellman, said to me once, he for a long time worked for the National Endowment for the Arts in their expansion of arts program. He was saying that before us, there really was no public sector in the arts. There hadn't been a public sector in the arts since the 1930s and the WPA arts projects. It's been 25 years. Basically, what public art was in the United States before the Black arts movement was, say, Lady Bird Johnson's, you know, Lyndon Johnson, the president's wife's highway beautification program. And what they did is that they made the idea of public art to be a mass idea. We don't really think, you know, the National Endowment of the Arts has created the National Endowment for the Humanities, NPR, PBS, all these things that we think of as sort of normal. They're somewhat embattled. There's great debates around them. But nonetheless, they exist, and it doesn't seem strange to anybody, I think, in the United States, the idea of public support for the arts. But not public support for the arts, just like the Metropolitan Opera House or the Metropolitan Museum of Art or the Guggenheim or whatever, you know, the sort of old heavyweights of the arts establishment. But the idea that of support of public arts and communities, which have been, I guess we might say, traditionally underserved by arts institutions, whether you're talking about a neighborhood like, say, in those times like Bedford-Stuyvesant in New York City, or you're talking about cities like Youngstown, Jamestown or Cleveland or Buffalo or Newark, New Jersey, the late Amiri Baraka's hometown, where they weren't on what you might think of as the Circle Line tour of arts institutions in the United States. So they changed the way we all look at it. The idea that art can be for the people, should be for the people, that it can be brought to the people, and that our tax dollars could pay for this. And they've asked, you know, why shouldn't our tax dollars pay for this? I mean, everybody, black people pay taxes like everybody else. Why shouldn't those tax dollars go towards cultural institutions in the community? The other thing I think that's really consequential about the black arts movement in terms of how it changed everybody's attitude in the United States about art is the idea that art can be serious and popular at the same time. Now, nowadays, that seems completely unremarkable to us. For example, if you're into hip-hop at all, the idea that hip-hop artists, whether you're going back to The Message and Raheem and Grandmaster Flash and Furious Five or Public Enemy or KRS-One or really right down to the present and Common and Talib Kweli, and we understand that millions of people listen to them. They may not be the most popular rappers, but certainly people are aware of them. But they also have a artistically, aesthetically, and thematically radical aspect to their work and serious aspect to their work. And similarly, you know, even artists who we don't necessarily think of as being political as such or serious as such, or many people might not think of, whether you're talking about Kanye West with New Slaves, or you're talking about Lil Wayne with God Bless America, those are enormously popular works that are also making a sort of visually serious, in the case of the videos, sonically serious and radical, and thematically radical and serious commentary, or does that kind of work. And this was really kind of unthinkable before black arts. So from there, then, you know, one of the problems is that from the perspective of a teacher, if I can talk about our book, SOS, Calling Our Black People a Black Arts Movement Reader, that I edited with Sonia Sanchez and John Bracey, is that we realized that we believed that it was this consequential and that a new scholarship had arose in the United States and beyond about that moment that gave new value and sort of recognized the contributions of black arts and black power, but actually were trying to teach those works. There was no way to do it without making students buy a million books, violating about 1,000 copyright laws, and having access to a major research library. So what we did is we decided that we needed to put out something that displayed black arts in all its complexity, in all its contradictions, in all its varieties, or at least as much as we could get into, about 800 pages. So it's pretty long, but it's in some kind of affordable fashion. The other thing that we wanted to do is we didn't want people to just look at words on the page, so we asked people who had been active in the movement back in the day to write introductions and write reminiscences about what it was like to be active in the theater or active as a poet or active in criticism and so on and so forth. Go to listen to music back in the era of the black arts movement to give people, young people who might not have actually lived through it, a sense of the texture of everyday life, what it was like. Amiri Baraka was certainly the most consequential figure of the black arts for a lot of reasons. Hello, my name is Jim Smethers. I teach African American literature and culture.
That's right. That was Jim Smethers. He is he teaches African American literature and culture at University of Amherst, University of Massachusetts Amherst, along with Dr. John H. Bracey, and in addition to those two professors, along with Sister Sonia Sanchez, they co-edited an anthology, SOS, Calling All Black People a Black Arts Movement Reader. And what we're offering this evening for your pledge of support of $45, I'm trying to present it properly, but I'm not doing as I should, I guess. But I'll get better. See, I'm feeling a little rusty, but hey, what's going to happen for a pledge of $45? You could actually receive this audio that was recorded That conversation that was, that's only part of the conversation that I had with Jim Smithert. And he later talks about Amiri Baraka. And, yeah. And we sort of set things up for John H. Bracey. Professor John H. Bracey, also of University of Massachusetts Amherst. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. Persons have told me that they are interested, and this is before they even heard the what was being presented. What you're listening to right now, of course, is Acknowledgement Part 1 from A Love Supreme. I had actually planned on, never mind. And it's Train. It's John Coltrane. That's what I needed to play, and that's what we're listening to. And you need to acknowledge WBAI and its existence and its what it's provided. Major special thanks to Brenda Green, Dr. Brenda Green of Medgar Evers College, the Center for Black Literature, and in allowing Dred Scott Keyes to record the book release that occurred there. I think that was October 9th. I have to check my own notes. But there was a presentation at Medgar Evers, and of course it included James Smithert, Sonia Sanchez, and James H. Bracey, the co-editors of SOS, Calling All Black People a Black Arts Reader, Black Arts Movement Reader. And we need you to call 212-209-2950, or you could go to give2wbai.org. As I mentioned, for a pledge of $45, this is a two CD set. It's a little over 2 hours of a mix. As you noticed, I slipped in some Nikki Giovanni. That happened during the moment that we had Nikki Giovanni as our guest on Sugar My Bowl. And so it seemed appropriate as she was talking about soul and her involvement with soul and what the impact of soul did for... It was definitely part of the Black Arts Movement. It was a statement. It was in the tradition of Black Arts. It was, it was a powerful show. Ellis Hazlett. As a matter of fact, there's a documentary being worked on by his niece, Melissa Hazlett, and I am eagerly awaiting its release. And it focuses on the series, Soul. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to pledge your support to WBAI. For as little as $5, you can pledge your support to you can go to give2wbai.org and pledge. Because we need your assistance, as was mentioned by Jim Smithers. The Black Arts Movement pretty much introduced the idea of public support to people. As he mentioned, it was, Lady Bird Johnson, beautification of the highway. That's not public support. Public support is WBAI, Pacifica Radio. Pacifica Radio. He didn't mention Pacifica Radio. Pacifica Radio precedes NPR and PBS. There was listener support here before there was anywhere it was happening in those other institutions. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to continue that support. We do need your assistance. We always need your assistance. That's why, he's like, oh, they're always asking for help. Because we need it. We still do not accept public, we want public, corporate support or corporate endorsement or, they may be rethinking, who knows, but right now, as has been for over 50 years, we do not accept corporate support or what is it called? Oh, I can't think of the name right now because I'm trying to rush and get to the next thing. 212-209-2950 is the number to call. 212-209-2950. We need to hear from you. We need to continue to hear from you throughout the evening. What is happening here? Okay, I'm actually going to do some. Okay, there it is. Oh my gosh, what just happened? Okay, that's what I want. I'm playing samples from, gosh, I sort of want to do this Jim Smithers thing, the rest of it. Because he starts to talk about Amiri Baraka, but I may just go on to James Bracey. But we need to hear from you. Yeah, I'm going to go to James, to John Bracey, because I actually start off this one hearing from Amiri Baraka. Now, let's go to Jim Smithers. See, if you had this two CD set at home, you could play whatever you want. You wouldn't have to count on me. But I think it's kind of important what he has to say about Amiri, as everyone else. It's not just about Amiri, just so you know. But he's important. He's very important, and he is missed still by me, and I am sure many others. 212-209-2950. Give the number to WBAI.org.
I said before, there was no Pope of black arts, and Amiri Baraka certainly was not that. And in fact, at his most influential during the movement, even people who worked very closely with him, people like Askia Touré, for example, a very important figure who now lives in Boston, but was mostly in New York and Atlanta during this period, a little bit in Detroit, had no problem writing critical things about Baraka. But nonetheless, Baraka, I think, was really a key figure. I mean, one of the things about Baraka that was really so important is that his capacity is not only for writing great poetry and for writing great drama and performing it well. He was the best reader of poetry I've ever seen, hands down. And a great polemicist, I might also say, you know, a great person to make very powerful arguments. But I think one of the things that is sometimes underestimated about him, since he was a great organizer and he had really had a head for organizing when he wanted to devote his energy that way. And he was somebody who was like that through his whole life. Before his time in the Black Arts Movement in the Bohemia downtown Manhattan, Baraka was the one who organized. He published magazines. He had a little book series. Who published all the important, you know, people like Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and Frank O'Hara, published all these really important poets of that we might call the Beat Movement of the New York poets. In many cases, was their first major publication. He was great about bringing the different schools of those poets and writers and artists together to give them a sense of a common identity. And he just had a tremendous skill for building institutions, for bringing people together, for thinking in that kind of way. So that under the influence, like almost everybody in the movement, as my colleague John Bracey talks about, as he moves uptown after the murder of Malcolm X to start the Black Arts Repertory Theater, partly in response to a call by Malcolm X and the Organization for Afro-American Unity for a cultural center and school in Harlem, that he immediately starts pulling all sorts of different people together of building things. He has an artistic sense, he has an institutional sense, he has a kind of political sense, which helps, I mean, it's enormously powerful in helping build the movement. So as a result, the Black Arts Repertory Theater and School had a variety of problems which caused it to disintegrate. And then he moves back to his hometown of Newark, New Jersey, where he spends the next 40-some-odd years, really going close to 50 years, and builds over there. But that he's somebody who becomes not only a major cultural leader, but is a major political leader, the crucial person in the election of Kenneth Gibson to become the mayor of Newark, the first Black mayor of a major city in the eastern United States. I mean, a lot of other people obviously made it happen, but he was the linchpin of it. He was the linchpin of the Congress of African People's first convention in Atlanta, Georgia, which brought together huge strands of cultural people, political people together into what I think of as one of the most important moments of Black arts and Black power. He's a major, major figure, really the major figure. Again, there are a lot of people that work with him of the National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana in 1972. So that, Baraka, I think, through his great art, but also in so many genres. Again, there probably has not been an American artist who has written as well in as many genres of literature as Amiri Baraka since Langston Hughes, who Baraka knew. Langston Hughes encouraged Baraka as a young man, and really to the day of Baraka's death, he had a framed letter from Langston Hughes to him encouraging him, hanging in his house in Newark. So he was just, I don't know how to say it, a great spirit, and contrary to what some people said, had a real capacity to connect to people in the grassroots. He was an amazing guy. And the other thing I'll say that was amazing about Baraka, this is true of a lot of the Black arts people, though. He's a good example. I mean, it's true of Sonia Sanchez. It's true of Haki Madhubuti. It's true of Nikki Giovanni, is that they continued to be active and productive. And Baraka was writing some of his best poetry ever, in my opinion, right up at the end. And he was writing poetry right up to the day that he died. His son, who is now the mayor of Newark, he was sort of campaigning among the nurses in the hospital in Newark practically while he was on his deathbed. And, we should all go out that way.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.